the Honorable Judges of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit.
Please be seated. As I said, we're having your argument in our last case, 12-21-23, Sawyer v. Asbury. Ms. Grube, Reeve.
Thank you, Your Honor. And, I apologize, I was in the wrong courtroom. I wondered why the panel had changed, but they were able to locate me.
You were in the wrong courtroom already?
I was in the wrong courtroom this morning.
Okay, let me know, it's a lesson to be in the future, because if you had, I dare say if you hadn't gotten this panel, you might, your case may be gone.
Thank you. My name is Wendy Grieve. I come from Charleston, West Virginia. I've been here once before. We're here today about constitutional rights, and not just constitutional deprivations, but also constitutional rights, most particularly the Seventh Amendment right to a trial by jury. My client, Jim Asbury, was accused of constitutional deprivations under the Fourth Amendment by Brian Sawyer. After Sawyer had been arrested, he was booked, and during the booking process, he claims that he had a broken nose and other injuries because of excessive use of force.
So he did have a broken nose?
He did have a broken nose, but his claim was that it was approximately caused by excessive use of force, therefore resulting from a constitutional deprivation. Now, after a jury verdict in favor of my client, the jury found that, in fact, there had been no violation of the 14th Amendment. The judge re-reviewed the evidence, which in this case was a video. The trial transcript hadn't been done yet, by my understanding, so it was really the video that he was relying on.
The district court sat through the trial, presumably.
Yes.
Experienced district judge. Very experienced lawyer before that.
Correct. A very experienced judge, and he had seen the video during the motion for summary judgment process. The video was played for the jury ad nauseum. I tried to count how many times. It was difficult because we would play part of it, and then opposing counsel and I would each go through stills with each witness, and there were four witnesses. So, and the jury also had the video with them, and when they were reviewing the evidence before rendering their verdict. So there's no dispute that all of the evidence was presented to the jury. Here, however, the judge viewed the evidence differently. He granted a motion for judgment as a matter of law under Rule 50 after the jury found for the defendant. The basis for this was solely on parts of the video evidence. In doing so, it is our belief that he ignored the other evidence that was presented. Rule 50 does not allow a district court to weigh the evidence.
He said he didn't. He said no weighing of the evidence or credibility determinations are permitted. I made none. So he knew he couldn't, and he said he didn't.
Well, that is correct. I think he knows what the law is, and I'm sure that if he believed that he was not following the rule, he would not have issued that order. But we are all at times incorrect, district courts too. The video, as relied upon by the judge in his order did not refer to any of the evidence other than the video. The judge specifically
found... Well, we know in the Supreme Court that if evidence conflicts with the video controls, correct?
Correct. And in fact, I relied on...
So that doesn't strike me as immediate an error.
Correct. However, in this case, the video doesn't conflict with the evidence. It was the judge's weighing of the evidence and assessing credibility of witnesses that in doing so, he weighed the video and his interpretation of it higher than the testimony of the witnesses. What's critical to point out here is this is not a movie that was played by the judge or by the jury. This was a stilted, motion-activated...
I think you can rest assured that we've all looked at the video.
Okay, thank you. In fact, the district court admits, you know, what he recites in the order, granting judgment as a matter of law, what he recites are physical acts. Then concludes that those physical acts per se constitute a 14th Amendment deprivation. And in so doing, it is our position that he had to have ignored the testimony from all law enforcement officers about the basis for those acts.
But can I just ask, the video makes plain that there was no physical aggression by the appellee before your client lunged at him.
I disagree, Your Honor. And I disagree for this reason. If we look at the actual evidence that was brought in, the police officers testified that there were a number of events that occurred and displays of a threat by Mr.
Right.
Sawyer.
Right. They said he was turning his head.
Correct.
I mean, what is threatening about turning one's head?
Well, I asked the same question. And accordingly, that turning your head while you're undergoing a pat-down with your arms against the wall.
Well, they said also crossing one's arms is
correct.
Some kind of aggression.
Correct. Law enforcement refers to the initial one as a target glance. When the individual who's undergoing a pat-down is told to look at the wall and continues to look back at the officer to size him up, the law enforcement officers, and the testimony was, they were trained that this is indicative of a threat. Now, that evidence was not disputed, and that evidence isn't part of the video, but it had to have been discounted and not considered at all and weighed by the judge.
No, but counsel, we saw the video. I know what you're talking about is when the officer was removing the handcuffs, he took one hand at a time, one hand, I guess for police, because you want to be able to feel whether or not the person is moving, so you have one hand high, other hand low, and he
correct.
Switched hands to do that. But even that, what you say, he looked back, but there's a break there. He looked back, but then he's sitting down after that. So that looking back couldn't have been the basis for the lunging choke.
No, Your Honor. One event does not trigger another event. It's a cumulative set of circumstances that we cannot view in a vacuum.
So he would doubt where the point is that, you know, I see your point is that he's ratcheting up in terms of a potential person for violence.
Exactly, Your Honor.
All right.
And that's why, in and of itself, we completely agree that the potty mouth that Mr. Sawyer was displaying that evening, in and of itself, and what we called idle threats, like my client testified, well, sure, he threatened to kill my wife, but I don't have one. So, I mean, that's not
and
something
client,
that
I think acknowledged, albeit not very forthrightly, that he couldn't remember, but that he may have also been engaging in some unpleasant language.
Correct, right there in the booking process.
That's there in the record.
Right there at the booking process. So that's not what we're saying was indicative of the threat. What is indicative of the threat to the law enforcement officers and the evidence that was presented to the jury, and not the video, was an escalation, the target glance, the locking up of the body. And understand the locking up of the body, this video has no audio. The locking up of the body is in conjunction with the refusal to obey lawful verbal commands by law enforcement officers. Every law enforcement officer testified, and this was not disputed at trial, that this individual, based upon their perception, posed a threat.
Did that appear their worry about that on the video? One of them sitting at his desk doing something?
They indicated
when I'm threatened, I'm usually, or if you see a friend that's threatened.
They did not perceive that the testimony was that they did not perceive that Deputy Asbury would have any difficulty in handling the threat. When the threat became physical, the officers reacted. Now, there's testimony about, well, what does that reaction time mean? Did they react fast enough? Well, that doesn't mean that somebody's constitutional rights were deprived. The amount of time an individual takes to process what's occurring and their response time is not dispositive of the issue of whether or not Mr. Sawyer's constitutional rights were deprived. Now, the physicality that the court discusses, the court relies on interpretation and not actual contact in finding that the video displays unlawful excessive force. There is no punch landing on Mr. Sawyer. The court interprets a movement by Mr. Sawyer's head following movement by Jim Asbury's arm as conclusive of a constitutional tort. Now, or constitutional deprivation.
Was there testimony by your client that he never lands a punch? Was the testimony on the other side?
I'm sorry?
What is the testimony on the other side?
The testimony on the other side changed. The testimony on the other side was...
Changed from when to when?
Every single time the plaintiff made a statement under oath. The first time the plaintiff testified that he was punched, he testified that he was punched by Jim Asbury during the pat-down.
What did the plaintiff testify to at trial?
Three things. He testified that he had been punched by Jim Asbury when he was standing up against the wall being patted down. Then he testified that was wrong. He was actually punched in the face repeatedly while Deputy Asbury was sitting on his back after they were trying to handcuff him after
we can't see that.
Takedown.
The video doesn't tell us the right answer to that one way or the other.
Right, and then he said, no, I must be wrong again. And during the trial testified, after seeing the video for the first time, he said, oh, that's where I was punched. Okay, so we have three different versions,
well,
and that's
we have
what the
two. You have your client saying he didn't punch him then, and we have the plaintiff saying he did punch him then.
Correct, and we have...
And we have the tape.
Correct, we have the tape. Now, what is consistent with the movement, the judge appears to conclude that there was a punch, and we can separate punch, too, from an unlawful constitutional deprivation, but the first is that the judge interprets a punch. The testimony from all law enforcement officers were, one, there wasn't a punch, and two, that movement was consistent with what actually occurred, and that is the application of a pressure point in the upper chin line or jawline area. Completely consistent testimony with what is shown on the video. Now, what you also don't see on the video is you don't see blood coming out of his nose. Okay? Now, this race ipsa argument, I think, is what the court is actually saying. Guy walks into a booking room. Guy comes out with a bloody nose. We don't know it's fractured. It's not a shattering of the nose. It's a broken nose that he gets an ibuprofen for. Now, because that occurred, there had to be a deprivation of his 14th Amendment rights. There was an injury, and there's no explanation for the injury. Well, that's not what the law is. The law is that law enforcement are entitled to use force for a legitimate purpose. And here, there was no evidence that contradicted the law enforcement officer's testimony, whether their belief was correct or not. There was reasonable for a law enforcement officer to anticipate and expect that Mr. Sawyer was an imminent threat. And based upon their training and experience, they had the right to go hands-on at that moment. The hands-on that the law enforcement officers testified to were pressure points and a takedown and a shoving of the plaintiff up against the wall.
What I don't understand is this. It's undisputed by the film or the video that he was sitting down at the time, correct?
Correct.
What did the officer want him to do?
Stand. He was sitting down in defiance of the commands. Ironically, to be photographed.
No, the time is out, and the judge, lead judge, is being gracious that we asked this question. So let's keep it very narrow.
Okay.
What did he want him to do?
To stand up to be photographed.
Stand up to be photographed.
Correct.
All right. So the pressure point was to get him up.
No, Your Honor. After he was told three times to get up, to be photographed. Then he threatened to take the badge.
Right.
And then Deputy Asbury testified that then physically Sawyer moved towards him. And at that point, Deputy Asbury went in because he perceived that
and
as a threat.
And that's what the judge said he didn't see on the video.
That's what the judge says he didn't see on the video.
Yeah. And I must say it's rather elusive too when I saw it.
You know, I mean, that's why we have to go with the law enforcement officers who are on the scene.
No, what the Supreme Court's told us, we go with the video. That used to be the law.
But
you had no video here.
I don't think that the video illustrates that this law enforcement officer was unreasonable in perceiving a threat at that time.
I understand that your position.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel?
May it please the court. I'm John Bryan from Union, West Virginia, and I represent Brian Sawyer, the plaintiff in the underlying case. And Your Honors, it's an honor to be here, and it has been an honor for me to be involved in this case. The district court below said it best in the May 18th order almost a year ago today, when Judge Goodwin wrote, "What the video shows cannot be reconciled with the jury's verdict. The video shows Deputy Asbury grabbing the plaintiff by the throat. The video shows Deputy Asbury punching the plaintiff in the face with his fist. The video shows the officers leaving the injured Mr. Sawyer lying on the holding center floor. Mr. Sawyer walked into the holding center uninjured, and he left with a fractured nose and a battered face. While Mr. Sawyer's verbal threats against Deputy Asbury were disgusting, they were still only words. And the pretrial detainee's words do not justify an officer's use of such force. There are essentially two issues before the court today. The first is whether the district court exceeded its authority in granting our renewed motion for judgment as a matter of law, or this jury ignored overwhelming evidence, videotaped evidence, that Deputy Asbury used excessive force, causing a facial fracture and other facial injuries in violation of the 14th Amendment. The second issue is whether the district court properly denied qualified immunity to Deputy Asbury, again, where we have a videotaped evidence and other evidence, which is indisputable, showing that Deputy Asbury choked and punched Mr. Sawyer for quote, merely running his mouth."
Counsel, you tried this case, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you heard the testimony of the officer, what he described, what he said was the pressure point that he was trying to get to, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would you point to, on your body, where about, based on where that was?
Well, the...
Can you point to on your body where, bless you, where it was?
Well, I don't believe, Your Honor, that this was a pressure point tactic.
Where do I ask you to relate the testimony?
It would be right to the throat. It was essentially a choke. I would call it a choke, and Deputy Kearns and Deputy Massey
I'm not making any conclusion about whether it's a choke or not. This is just position on the body. That's all. So it is around the neck?
Deputy Asbury admitted that his hands were on the throat of Mr. Sawyer. And the other deputies...
But that is also his testimony. And that's his testimony. I'm not asking you to concede it. That is also physically where the alleged pressure point is also. Correct?
Correct, Your Honor. And actually, Deputy Kearns, he actually alleged that there were, instead of a choke and a punch, there were two separate pressure point tactics. One to behind the ear and one to the throat area and one to behind the ear. And
well, my next question is this. Why couldn't the jury conclude that what they saw was an officer going for that pressure point at his throat? As apparently, I guess we assume they did.
Well, the district court ruled that...
No, I'm not talking about the district court. I'm talking about the jury. It was the finder of fact. Why could they not believe, since the testimony was that it was in the throat area, and it clearly shows he did go for the throat. Now, in the video, it doesn't get to the point of fine-tuning as to, but it was the throat. Why couldn't the jury, as it presumably did, conclude that the officer was going for a pressure point to control him and not, as we would call colloquially, choke him? That's my question. Why would that not be a reasonable interpretation of the facts for the trial facts here?
Because, Your Honor, Deputy Asbury did not testify that he was trying to inflict a pressure point tactic.
Oh, he did? I thought you said that's what he said. That was. I'm sorry, I misunderstood that.
No, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
He didn't testify that he was going for a choke?
No, Your Honor.
Counsel said that that's what he was going
for. It was Deputy Kearns who testified for the first time ever. My first experience meeting him was at the jury trial, so I was kind of surprised that he said this.
What's the testimony as to Asbury as to why he went around the throat there?
Here's what Asbury said. Asbury admitted that he asked asked Mr. Sawyer three times to stand up, and that when he refused, he then applied force.
Just force.
He said he applied force. Mr. Asbury admitted that he, being Asbury, made a sudden movement towards Mr. Sawyer, grabbing him in the throat area, was his testimony, and that was page 182 in the joint appendix. Deputy Asbury admitted that Mr. Sawyer was sitting down at the time that he was attacked, and that Mr. Sawyer was given no warning that sudden physical force was about to be inflicted on him. Mr. Asbury admitted that Mr. Sawyer never physically assaulted him or any other officer that day in the holding center, but that he was merely just running his mouth. Deputy Asbury testified that he inflicted force on Mr. Sawyer, merely because he deemed the threats that Mr. Sawyer was making as requiring him to inflict force.
In other words, a preemptive strike.
A preemptive strike, Your Honor.
Well, okay, maybe you can help me with the JA, because as far as the throat is concerned, you asked him, is it true that you grabbed Brian Sawyer, that you had your hands on his neck? No. You didn't choke him? No.
That's a 183.
It's at 183, the top of 183.
Okay, let's see.
And on 189, he says he didn't punch Mr. Sawyer.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I have two actual citations for the, when I said that Asbury admitted that he made a sudden movement towards Sawyer, grabbing him in the throat area, I have two separate citations for that. It's 182.
Right.
182, lines 1 through 3 on that page 98 of the trial transcript. And also,
that says, would it be fair to say that when you grabbed a hold of Brian Sawyer, that it was a very sudden movement on your part? Yes?
And, Your Honor, that was a sudden movement part. And for the throat area part, that came from, I believe, Joint Appendix page 186, lines 1 through 9, which hopefully that lines up to what I wrote down.
Well,
and he did testify his deposition as well that he put his hand
in. Deposition. So it's your deposition. Did you ever place your hands around his neck? Answer, I placed my hand on his chest, in the upper chest and throat area. Yes. And then he responds, yes, that is correct. So he's affirming his deposition testimony. So does that refresh your recollection? He says, in my deposition, apparently I said chest and throat.
Yes, Judge Monson. In any event, Mr. Asbury did admit to inflicting force on Mr. Sawyer suddenly, without any warning, while Mr. Sawyer was sitting down, and that in that infliction of force that his hand, even Asbury admits, went into the throat area. He did not say that he was using a pressure point tactic that he was trained at the academy on or anything like that.
No, he says, you admit you did not give Brian Sawyer any warning that you're about to use sudden physical force against him. Answer, I did not.
That is correct, Your Honor. And Mr. Asbury denies striking Brian Sawyer in the face. He denies punching him. He denies striking him in the back of the head, causing his face to impact with the ground, or anything like that. Now, this is important, especially in light of the fact that Deputy Asbury admits that he was the person who was in control of Mr. Sawyer's head and shoulders during this ordeal. So we know that it wasn't anybody else who may have inadvertently caused these facial injuries to Mr. Sawyer. If anyone did it, it was the only person there at his head and shoulders was the defendant Asbury. Now, Mr. Asbury also admitted that Mr. Sawyer was injured as a result of the use of force that he inflicted against him. He admitted, and this is in...
question. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yes, Your Honor.
Before your time is up, though, I wanted to ask it. In the district judge's opinion, he says that the guilty plea of the plaintiff in connection with what transpired at the home was, in terms of assaulting Deputy Asbury at the home, was not related to what happened at the holding center. And I guess my question would be, if you're an officer looking at the events as they're unfolding at the holding center, wouldn't it be part of the calculus that you could consider that there was this event at the home prior to getting to the holding center that would be make it reasonable to interpret the body language of Mr. Sawyer as threatening?
Well,
I mean, here he was just moments a little bit earlier, the same night, he's engaged in contact with the officer that leads to a guilty plea for assaulting the officer.
What happened at the house was, and I mean, I'm going to answer your question. What happened at the house was my client, Mr. Sawyer, his testimony was that he was upset that he was being taken out of his house and arrested, and he kicked at his own door. He just was frustrated, kicked at his door on the way out.
Well, I think the testimony was something like Deputy Asbury moved out of the way, and it ended up that he kicked the door.
Well, that's what Asbury said.
My client
always said, maintained that he kicked at his door. He didn't try. He kicked at, like, the door frame.
Except for when he pled guilty.
Right. Right, and that's common, and my experience in criminal defense tells me that. You know, if they charge you with two or three different things, and they offer you a plea deal, you plead guilty to this, and you get no jail time, minimum fine, he's going to take it.
It may be, but it becomes your trail.
Yes, it's a fact.
It's a fact.
How much time elapsed from apprehending him at his house? How far is his house from the station?
I don't know that, Your Honor. Parkersburg is not a huge city, but after, I can tell you what happened after he kicked at the door frame. My client alleged that at that time, Asbury choked him. That was the first time that he choked him, and we had a Fourth Amendment claim based on that, and the judge issued summary judgment on that because of the guilty plea. But after that, another officer arrived at the scene. Brian Sawyer was placed in handcuffs, and he alleged that he was choked while he was in handcuffs. But
so the continuation of physicality between the two of them?
No, there was no continuation, Your Honor.
What I mean by it, there was a
continuation of abuse, according to him.
Abuse, right.
Well, Brian Sawyer did allege that he was kind of slammed into the patrol cars he was being put in, mm-hmm. in handcuffs. And so once inside the cruiser, the evidence was, and I believe it's undisputed, that Brian Sawyer was running his mouth in the cruiser, saying things that would, you know, that would upset, that he was trying to upset Deputy Asbury, but otherwise he was being physically compliant.
But
he was not.
But doesn't that put him in a high, elevated category? I'm going to take the facts best to your client. He was frustrated, he kicked the door, and he was choked, he was put in violently, his head into the cruiser. And he's still mouthing at armed police officers. Did your client admit those crude things?
He was saying some disgusting things to Mr. Asbury. He said, you know, do you wonder what your wife is doing this time of night or something like that?
They're awful things, but we'll agree they're crude. But the point is this, doesn't that put you in an incredible category? Most people shiver in their boots when a police officer stops them with a blue light on the highway for speeding. Let alone police officers have already done these things to you. I'm taking that as your word. I mean, in terms of what your client said. And he's still arrogant or whatever, and have enough chutzpah, whatever you want to call it, to say, and you did this, and your wife, and I'll take your badge and shove it up your derriere. I mean, doesn't that put you in a category where the police officer's like, this guy's real deal?
Judge, legally, I don't believe it has any effect on this, but factually, I think it's part of the reason why we're here. The jury, of course, as any jury would, did not like what Mr. Sawyer said. They did not like what he said. But as far as it making it, you know, reasonable for him to be choked and punched, it did not, because Mr. Sawyer was physically compliant, even though he was running his mouth in the vehicle. He wasn't shaking the vehicle. He wasn't spitting. He wasn't doing anything physical. He was led out of the vehicle, no problem. He went into the holding center, no problem. When he walked in, he was asked to sit on the concrete bench by Deputy Kearns. He complied. He sat down. He was asked to stand back up. He stood up. And at that point, they took his handcuffs off. And if he was such a threat, or if he was dangerous, they would not have taken his handcuffs off. And once they took his handcuffs off, he complied, he put his hands on the wall, and after his handcuffs were off, they told him to sit back down, he sat back down. It was only after that point that Deputy Asbury walked up to him, stood over him, And we can't hear what was said, but you can see that they're both arguing with each other. And Deputy Asbury admits that not only was Brian Sawyer running his mouth, but he was running his mouth back at him. So, in my opinion, that is not proper police tactics. If you are really worried that this person could be violent, and there were three other officers there, just in case there were any problems, they were unconcerned off to the side. If there was any problems, you shouldn't have taken the handcuffs off. And if there were any problems, you should not have escalated the situation by getting up in his face, pounding on your chest. And you can see in the video that Brian Sawyer, and this is consistent with his testimony, that he crossed his arms and crossed his legs.
His elbow went up a couple of times. What was he doing then?
I believe they were arguing, and he was.
But his elbow did like this a couple of times. What was he doing? I don't know, but he did. I saw that. What was he doing?
I think he made a couple hand gestures, as maybe I'm doing right now, even not even realizing it. But his testimony was that he crossed his arms and crossed his legs because he felt like Asbury was trying to provoke him into some sort of physical altercation.
Well, the officer basically says that, too, because he shouldn't be crossing his arms and legs. He was doing that. He was showing that he wasn't cooperating. Didn't the officer testify that way?
The officer said that he asked him three times to stand up and that he didn't, so he used force on him.
And then earlier today, I think that your colleague said that also crossing legs was bad. And so it seems to me that the parties are consistent on that your man was crossing his arm, crossing his legs. You think that's okay? They think it's bad. But there's no argument about what he was doing.
Certainly, Your Honor. I mean, we can see it on the video, but
how long is the video in total?
It's very difficult to watch, Judge. In total,
I have watched it. I want to know. I thought maybe you could tell me how long it is in total, starting where the video begins and where the video ends, not just this incident.
Well, the problem is there's two different time frames. One is real time when you press play, and then the other is actual time when you're watching the time elapse on the video, because it freezes. It freezes, and it might be stuck at, you know, 20...
Okay, so in real time, how much time elapsed between the time he came in and the time that this altercation began?
This happened maybe within 6 to 8 minutes, probably, and then he was left on the floor, which I did count for, I believe, 14 minutes.
The problem is, counsel, I have, though, is this, if you help me with this, it's the beauty of living in America. We have a land of liberty and freedoms. And in the rare situations, the police officer is one of the few people, maybe the only person that can put their hands on you unless another person is defending themselves from your aggression. They could then. So since police officers are authorized to put their hands on you, if a police officer gives you a command three times to do something and you don't do it, isn't the police officer authorized to put his or her hands on you?
There are de-escalation techniques, there are soft hand techniques, there is the act of just putting hands on somebody and handcuffing them, standing them up. He skipped that and went straight. He skipped first and third basis.
Look at the history, though. The history is this man just assaulted me, which he pled guilty to. He's violent. He's saying crude, nasty things. He's using defiant gestures like folding his arms. He's saying all these things and saying, I'm going to, and a present threat, not I will, I'm going to take your badge and shove it up your rear end. And then you have to make a decision that this person who will not obey your command, and you clearly have the right to put your hands on him, then I think that I need to put my hands on a way that he can't not clearly come back at me. Like, ordinarily you might say, hey, buddy, let's move on. But there, you take a move that clearly controls you, because it's not really choking somebody to the point of taking breath out of it. It's using the throat to push you back, because the maneuver is your throat is so sensitive. If I have you around the throat, I can control your straight back and up. How do we say as a matter of law that video makes it so clear that a jury couldn't make that conclusion?
Judge, I'm out of time. I would like to...
Judge Moss would
be... You can answer the question.
Your Honor, and I would ask you also to look at the Jones v. Buchanan case.
I'll do my homework, but just answer that right now.
Well, Judge Moss, I know, authored the Jones v. Buchanan case out of this circuit, which is very similar.
Go ahead. Please compliment Judge Moss. I don't want you to miss the opportunity.
But maybe you rely on Jones. Do you have anything else to say in response?
Well, it's similar in that in that the person was being verbally belligerent, was saying foul things, and not only that, in that case, the person went to stand up and try to get out of the handcuffs or adjust them in some way. In this case, it's different because Mr. Sawyer didn't make any movements whatsoever. Deputy Asbury admitted that he could have asked the three other officers who were there available to assist in case there were any problems who were unconcerned. He could have asked them to help get Mr. Sawyer re-handcuffed or make him stand up if he wasn't going to stand up. But the fact is it was a physical use of force which undisputedly injured and fractured Mr. Sawyer's nose, and which was in response to mere words. There was no physical act of assault or aggression by Mr. Sawyer. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You have a few minutes.
I, too, have read the Jones decision, and I don't think that it really does apply. In the Jones case, that was Fourth Amendment, not 14th Amendment.
Well, I don't know why this isn't Fourth Amendment, too.
I mean,
pretrial detainees are Fourth Amendment.
Correct. The judge.
So everybody said it's 14th Amendment, but since it's sort of an equal opportunity error on everybody's part, I think you can pretty clearly think that this is a Fourth Amendment case.
And I think that we can apply that standard as well and still have
the
same results. I do know that. Now, what makes Jones the most distinguishable, and that I think we need to look back at this case and see why, is that in Jones, the court was dealing with a summary judgment issue, and they had to take the plaintiff's version of events in the light most favorable to the plaintiff. And here, Sawyer's entire argument is you need to take his version of events. And that's the point of this.
No, he says you have the video controls.
Sawyer.
And I think that that your argument, your best argument, is the argument that Judge Gregory's been making for you, that even if everything in the video took place, your man, and we have to assume it did take place because it's on the video, and the Supreme Court has told us the video controls, that your man was justified in doing what is shown on the video. Isn't that
correct?
Your best case?
Correct. Yes, it is, Your Honor. And also the best case is
but
that...
But then Jones is relevant because it says, taking those facts, you wouldn't be justified.
Well, in Jones's facts, the court had to say...
I understand it had to, but it sets up that as the standard.
Correct. Where there is no legitimate law enforcement purpose and where there is no reasonable belief of imminent threat to the officer, then...
Well, we know these facts are undisputed. There are three other officers in the room, right?
Correct.
And what was the other part of this? Did you say you have to show? Just a minute ago. 1 second ago.
No legitimate law enforcement reason for...
Right, for the deputy's actions and not reasonable.
Not biased, the legitimate law enforcement reasons for what we see on the tape. Not for what your client said he did, but for what we see on the tape.
What you see on the tape, I do believe, is consistent with what my client says he did. Now, it's hands-on. It's a level of force consistent with everything that my client viewed with respect to the escalation of threat to him. He did have experience with Brian Sawyer.
So your answer has to be that the use of force can be used when the other person, the pretrial detainee, is only using language. That the officer can use force in response to threats.
No, Your Honor.
Okay, so one
cannot be isolated from the other. In Jones, I believe the court was looking at the mere words because it had to take out of account the officer's representations that in that case, the plaintiff said he was handcuffed, officer said he wasn't. In this case, it's undisputed, one, that this individual was unhandcuffed.
Unhandcuffed, and there are three other people in the room, and there's
correct.
Still... this threat that he has to respond to by laying force on the man.
The law does not...
And resulting in
a fracture, right?
Right, he had a broken nose, which appeared, he had a bloody nose. That was visible only...
I thought you said it was broken, no?
That was
broken
visible.
Nose.
Correct. The officers did
you
not...
just told me it was a bloody nose. It was a broken, bloody nose.
Correct. And that was only visible to anyone after he got up off the floor. There was, in fact, one of the officers testified that he didn't even know that he had sustained an injury at all.
Well, they walked away.
They were right
and
there.
They walked away and left him there.
It's a distance of about 5.5 feet.
Walked away. His head is down, and they walk away. That's another thing. We have the tape.
Correct. I know, but I don't think his head is down. I think he's actually laying sideways, and you can see that as he shuffles over on the side. In any event, the court did not find that where he was behind the wall had anything to do with its determination that the jury was wrong. And what the court found was, and had to be under Rule 50, that the jury had no basis for finding the way that it did. And the sole source of the court's finding was its interpretation of the video. Now, what's on the video can't be disputed. What's not on the video also cannot be interpreted. And it is our position that is exactly what the district court did, was interpret what's not on the video, and in doing so, had to make a credibility determination that the only person telling the truth, and then he'd have to pick one version of the truth, was the plaintiff, and had to completely disregard and find as incredible the testimony of the officers. This is prohibited by the Seventh Amendment. This is prohibited by Rule 50. Jim Asbury was entitled to a jury, a fair jury trial, and it occurred. The jury saw the evidence, and it had to interpret it. The video doesn't tell everybody everything. The judge, no judge, has the right to go back and filter through all that evidence and weigh it and assess credibilities. And in our case, that's what occurred. Now, very briefly, the qualified immunity argument came into play because there were repeated mentions by the court that a punch alone is per se a constitutional deprivation. Now, if we assume a punch occurred, there is no law in the Fourth Circuit that alone a punch is per se excessive force. In this case, it was established that the officers did perceive threat. Well, if an officer perceives a threat and acts on it physically and punches somebody in the face, does that automatically make it a Fourth or 14th Amendment deprivation?
I know the judge can't assess credibility, and certainly we can't, but it's just interesting how consistent the officer's testimony is that it's a danger cue. For example, Kern said it's a danger cue if somebody is going to be looking back as you're being handcuffed or unhandcuffed, or if your arms are crossed. And it reminds me of the case, and I can't recall the name, from the Fourth Circuit, where the trial judge, or the police had argued that hanging, having your bag from the cleaners hanging in the car is a sign that you must have drugs in the car. And the district judge rejected that, and the Fourth Circuit affirmed. Might have been Gargliano, but I can't recall. Anyway, it seems like, why would somebody just having their arms crossed make it even seem like a threat? To me, it's somebody trying to make sure they don't do something wrong, so they're restraining themselves. And this is just an excuse to justify what happened.
And that's why, thank goodness, neither you nor I are in a position of having to assess threat. And that is what the law enforcement officer is trained to do. And they're trained, I don't know if it's right or wrong, but I can tell you that the body of police science that trains them and comes up with this says that these behaviors are indicative of a threat to an officer because they are, and this is the term of art that they use. I'm not a police officer, but I know I can use legal terms of art. These are their terms of art.
The trial testimony to that effect?
Yes.
Okay. So that was before the judge that there's a police science.
Well, not those words, but that was consistent with their training. The recognition in response to those cues were consistent with the training of all three officers. And if I may very briefly...
Why did they uncuff him then?
At that point, the threat had diminished, and they were going to uncuff him.
This is all within a few minutes.
Correct, and it escalated again. This individual
time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you. We will ask our
clerk to adjourn court, and then we'll come down and greet the lawyers.
This honorable court stands adjourned. Signed, aye. God save the United States and this honorable court.